Hello. Well, first and foremost, thank you for inviting me and giving me a chance to present these results. It's great to be here. Well, being a Canadian, I'm going to use the hockey stick. It's pretty nostalgic. So I'm going to tell you about a result that Alan Edelman and I have obtained. And we titled it Isotropic Entanglement. You'll see why. Before, let me just make some more acknowledgments. Okay, so first of all, Peter Shore, who's my advisor, and well, I've learned a lot from him, and so did I from Jeffrey Goldstone. He's been very benevolent and generous with his time and knowledge. And I also had a nice discussion with Aram Harrow when he was visiting us a couple of months ago at MIT. So since I have very little bit of time, let me just get into it as fast as I can. So Deppin just gave you a nice introduction into entanglement. We think of it as non-separability of states. You know, you bring two electrons together or what have you. They interact. The effective state is not a state that you can understand in terms of one and then the other. There's something more holistic. And, you know, it has, as again was just mentioned in the previous talk, it has some good blessings. For example, we can come up with algorithms, like a Shor celebrated algorithm where, you know, you can factorize numbers exponentially faster than a classical computer. And, you know, there are new physics like topologically protected entangled states. And best of all, it gives us all jobs. And there are some issues with it, such as entanglement is makes study of quantum systems hard on classical computers because it allows for so many new states, and the size of the operators and the states grow so much that it's hard to keep to update all the exponential number of parameters that you need. I'll specify these in more detail, and it is harder to imagine with classical intuition, and it is fragile in the sense that with small perturbations, you can lose it, so building quantum computers have proven to be kind of difficult. And it makes a lot of philosophers angry, but that's okay in this audience. So I'm going to show you the final slide first, and then build up to it, since I have a little bit of time. So this is a result of an exact diagonalization of a Hamiltonian. We'll talk about all sorts of details of it later. But I just want to tease your curiosity. So, you know, I have n equals 6, d equals 4. That means I have 6 particles, each one of which has 4 states. And it is a 4 local interaction for now. And r is the rank of the projection. I took it to be full rank. The interaction is full rank interaction. So, you know, it's what is it, 2 to the 12, 4096 by 4096 Hamiltonians. I can diagonalize that in a decent computer. And this is the eigenvalue distribution. Now, if I told you I had a theory, we had a theory that predicted or made an estimate of this distribution, how good should it look for you to be happy with the theory? How close should it be? If I drew it, anything?
Straight line.
Okay.
But how about this? Maybe I'm kidding.
In quantum information and in quantum physics, we usually talk about lattices. We put things on lattices. So these are lattices, two-dimensional lattices. Square lattice, honeycomb lattice. We put quantum particles on the vertices. And the edges usually correspond to some kind of interaction. We call these particles on the edges spins, qubits, quantum particles, things that Patrick covered in his talk in the morning. We call the generalization of qubits qubits. In this talk, they're all the same. So the general state of an embodied quantum system, quite irrespective of the particular laws of interaction, how they interact, the locality, and so forth, in the most general form can be written like this, with one constraint, and that is I put d states per particle. D being 2, you would have electrons interacting, a gas on lattice, it doesn't really matter. And as you can see, this tensor product nature of these bases are unit vectors in d dimensions, this tensor product will tell you that this state will be a d to the n by 1 vector living in the Hilbert space. Naturally, the operators, like Hamiltonians, acting on it will be d to the n by d to the n, so d to the n dimensional, grow exponentially with the number of particles. And this is, you know, that's some picture of it. So these spins are the particles, the edges are the interactions. You know, you can have four interactions with 4 neighboring sites, or you could have 2 local interactions, or what have you. So let's talk about the Hamiltonians. So In quantum many body systems, we're lucky. In the sense, we're lucky because the interactions usually are local. And these give rise to area laws, all sorts of wonderful things. And so the interactions usually, in here I just show you a two local interaction. It means every k, there's a nearest neighbor interaction all day. So if you take, so this full Hamiltonian, you can break it down in the case where it's only nearest neighbor interactions or two local interactions to the odd summons plus the even summons. You'll see why I do this. But so you can break this summation into the odd ones. So say particle one and two interact, and its identity, so its trivial interaction and everything else, plus the next term, where identity acts on these, then there's an interaction between these two, three and four, identity and everything else, and so forth, to the end. So the great, so if problem was like this, we would be in good company because, you know, these guys, you can locally diagonalize without any loss of generality. You could have a bunch of diagonal H's sitting there, and the net tensor product and the summation would still be diagonal. You would just work out the permutation and get the spectrum. Things would be easy. By conjugation, you could locally diagonalize. But it becomes problematic because you have the even pairs. So when the even pairs, so suppose you did diagonalize these guys, did whatever you could on those guys, but that would mess up the basis, diagonalization basis for the pink interactions or the even ones. So this, you know, the very generation of entanglement, the issues with the issues we face with diagonalizing these large matrices, it all boils down to this sharing of sites. These sharing of sites and interactions that allow for all sorts of entangled state. Long range, short range, what have you. So frustration is something I'm going to use later, so I'm just going to give you, for those who may not have heard of it, a very, very basic intuition. Suppose you have an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, which is this. This means nearest neighbor, IJ. You know, nature is economical, beautiful, and so forth, likes to minimize energy. And if J is a positive number, we call this an anti-ferromagnet. And it minimizes energy by anti-aligning. Because each one of the sigmas can be a plus or a minus one. You see that every term will give you a minus J contribution if the nearest neighbors are anti-aligned. Right? Clearly. And therefore, you know, you get minus J times the number of interactions as your total minimum energy. That'd be a ground state. And the cool thing about it is that locally the story is the same, right? I mean, you can understand the global configuration by just looking at it locally. Because locally also you can minimize energy by just having the spins point in two different directions. So let's notch it up a bit. So we say a quantum system is unfrustrated when its ground state is also the common ground state of all the local terms. Same concept here. I'm just showing you a classical included picture, but same concept in quantum mechanics. Where here, instead of the two local Hamiltonian, I'm showing you an L-local Hamiltonian. So every L neighboring sites interact inside the summons. So the case of frustration corresponds to when you change the geometry of the problem in the context of the interaction I just gave you. You could have two spins sitting here, anti-aligned, minimizing energy, everything is fine. You bring a third spin, we say it's frustrated because if it anti-aligns with this to minimize energy, it will have an energy cost here, and vice versa. So the spin is frustrated. And the frustrated systems are a lot more difficult because you wouldn't know if, so suppose, like stretch your imagination now, suppose there's a large lattice and so forth. You wouldn't know what the ground state would be for a large number of sites, right? I mean, you could have, finding the global minimum would be very difficult. There could be a morass of little local minima next to it and all sorts of complications. So frustrated systems are more difficult than frustration-free or unfrustrated ones. So this is what I just told you again. If you have an L-local interaction, the Hamiltonian can be written like this, where L is the number of sites it involves at once in the interactions, and trivial interaction identity and everything else. So everything good so far? All right. So to put things in context and have a concrete example by which we can compute and also connect it to our previous work, we take, and this is what we mean by generic, we take these interactions, the local interactions, to be random matrices of a certain rank. So again, Patrick Hayden in the morning told you that these guys are projectors of rank 1. You sum all of them, given that they're random, it would be an interaction or a projector of rank R, right? With probability 1. Because each one of them is a random vector. Now, so these VKs, given that they act on L sites at once, they're D to the L by D to the L, and the rank, as I said, is R. So these are the two parameters we have. In my simulations, I take it to be full rank, and I'll tell you why. So, you know, for people with mathematical inclination, you know that these are called Bishop matrices, where the R over DL plays the role of that other parameter, number of columns over rows. And in physics, these are Hamiltonians, are quantum spin classes, so double Hamiltonian six-member interactions. Okay? So we showed a while ago, Mary Beth knows about this result because I gave a talk on this last summer in the fields. So we showed that for such Hamiltonians on a line, if R, and this is interesting because it's a very sharp transition, if R, the rank of those local Hamiltonians, is less than or equal to d squared over 4 for two local interactions, d squared over 4, it's unfrustrated. So the system is unfrustrated, it's happy. But if R is greater than d squared over 4, the problem is overspecified. You'll be in the frustrated regime, where the local ground states are not the same as the global ground state necessarily. Now, this is just a previous work to just tell you what frustration would mean in the context of what I'm about to say. That would be R is bigger than d squared over 4. In particular, I'm going to take from now on my R to be d squared, as frustrated as it gets. Right? So let's go back and what is it that we are trying to solve? So the point is to understand the spectrum of these kind of Hamiltonians. That was the original motivation. That's a very hard problem to do exactly, because it's hard to diagonalize, and it's a major hindrance. However, we can do this. We can do this for arbitrarily n if the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian H promise to be random enough, stir the pot enough, point in random direction enough. And I'll make that more specific in the next slide. So the very generation of these entanglement via these random interactions and this mixing of the sites is yet another blessing. Though it's hard, makes things hard, it does help us in a different way. And that would be that it does introduce enough randomness where pre-probability theory starts becoming applicable. And I'm going to make this more specific in the next slide, and then hopefully show you some pretty pictures. So what do we mean by, you know, stir the pot enough and so on and so forth? So every one of the instances of that Hamiltonian I showed you, the big Hamiltonian, where the local terms are drawn from this random projectors, every one of them has a set of eigenvectors. If you put these eigenvectors in a matrix, that would correspond to a point. So suppose you have the unit sphere in the orthogonal group D to the N, which is the size of the large Hamiltonian. These eigenvectors would pierce this sphere at a point. So every point would correspond to an instance of the problem. Now, if you keep generating many instances of this problem, you do an ensemble of these big Hamiltonians with those local interactions that are Wisher type. If you put a dot for every one of those Hamiltonians, and these dots happen to cover the sphere uniformly enough with a Haar measure, so these eigenvectors are pointing random enough, and that's what we mean by random enough, then we're in good grounds. Our results become very, very powerful, well, very predictive. They match really well. Okay, so let me just tell you, there will be another talk on pre-probability tomorrow. So I'll just give you an intuitive picture of what I mean by pre-this and pre-that, pre-probabilities, and tell you how we use it, and just show you some pictures, the comparison of the theoretical work we've done with experiments, numerical experiments. So free probability theory is useful for the case where the random variables are non-commuting. So for all of us have had some Gaussian, you've seen the Gaussian random variables, statistical mechanics. You know, you grab two Gaussians, you add them, you get another Gaussian. And the case of non-commuting
random variables, like random matrices, free probability promises to answer that if you have one random matrix, you have another random matrix, you sum them, you know the distribution of one, you know the distribution of the other, you sum them, what's the distribution of the sum? Right? Generally, that's a very hard problem. You have a matrix you know all about, you have another matrix you know all about, given they are not diagonal. You add them, you know nothing about diagonal value distributions. Right? There are some bounds, but not adequate enough. However, so as you recall, in the commuting case, like Gaussian, just keep Gaussian variables in mind. So when you have a Gaussian variable x1 and Gaussian variable x2, you add them up, you don't add the distributions, right? I mean, there is Gaussian distribution, another Gaussian distribution. They don't add. But we know that the result is yet another Gaussian. So what does add is the cumulants, right? You can, one way of proving the central limit theorem is go via cumulants. You add the cumulants, you go backwards. Or the log of the characteristic, which is just a Fourier transform of the quality density. So those are additive. In the free probability case, where you have non-commuting random variables, the analogy is the free cumulant and the R transform. So R transform plays the role of log of characteristics and is additive. We're very lucky that that quantity is additive, because then we can that exactly is the reason why we can scale things up to arbitrarily n. And then undo our steps to get a distribution for the n particle, n summon problem. Okay, so there's one reference. And this is, okay, so fine. So our transforms, just to give more context, are obtained from the Cauchy transform of the distribution. Cauchy transform is any integral operator dx 1 over z to the minus x of some function of x, in this case, the distribution function. It is useful, it's a good notation, I think, to call g of z w at the same time. Lewis topology, but it becomes useful. So r of w can be written as z minus 1 over g of z, or g inverse of w minus 1 over w. And if a plus b is your random matrix c, the r transforms are additive. So I'm restating what I just said in the beginning of the slide. All right. So now let me show you some pictures. So the worst case, our worst case is this. So we have two local interactions where we don't quite get these points. However, you know, follows the tail very well, and you see that the high energy tail is also covered well. Now let me explain to you what the numerics are. So you know, to compare with exact diagonalization, I'm very limited, right? I mean, if I'm going to take D in all the simulations I'm going to show you, it's going to be D equals 4, N equals 6, because 2 to the 12, 4,096 by 4,096 is, you know, basically what we can do to diagonals, right? And if we're going to compare that to some theoretical plot, then, you know, this is the size we're gonna use, right? So here, that is the size. It's two local interaction, and it's full rank. That means D to the L is just D squared, is 16, right? And that's the prediction. I'll do this now for, please.
Oh, and so, okay, question. Suppose you have a chain, 1D chain, 1, 2, 3, n particles. Each one of them has d states. So d equals 2 is electrons, and when I say 2 local L equals 2, I mean it involves interactions like this, 2 interactions. It's, you know, 2 local, and L equals 2 in this case, okay? And R, in all cases, taken to the maximum possible d to the L. All right. So you have as many independent random projectors as you can to build your local interactions.
All
right. Thanks for asking.
May I just ask, what is the x-axis here? That's just the eigenvalue
That's
number
right.
in
That's
some
right.
order. What order did you choose?
What do I mean?
I mean.
So this is the histogram. This is the quality distribution for eigenvalues. So these are the eigenvalues,
oh,
and this is the probability.
I see.
Like a histogram, normalized histogram.
I see.
Okay.
So now I'm going to show you three local case. This is two local case. This is three local case. I don't complain about this. It's a four local case.
I'm sorry, and the black line is obtained by the convolution, by the non-commutative convolution? I mean, it's an analytical result.
Yes.
But what do you mean that exactly is average over 10 trials?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. The trials, so yes, black is theory. Mm-hmm. And the trials, I mean, so every instance you generate could give you a little bit of fluctuation, because it's just an instance. Mm-hmm. I average over 10 to just smooth out the fluctuation. I should go 100, but
the result, I mean, if you go further, the result should fall, like, almost surely that the average.
Respecting
that the size of the system goes to infinity, then the result should hold
should exactly.
for a right. Not in average, but for each instance.
That is a good question. So our transform technology that we use is an infinite technology, right? Our transform technology is an infinite technology. However, you know, if you're pragmatic and you're thinking like an applied mathematician or a physicist, then what you call infinite could be 15. N equals 6. So that one thing. And second thing is that results of free probability theory apply, but not trivial, in the sense that you're still going to work on it a bit. So though asymptotically many random matrices are free, this tensor product nature doesn't guarantee that this fits into any conventional type of asymptotically free in mathematical sense, not physical. Asymptotically free type of random matrices. So it's not like a Marchenko-Kastroa law, or it's not like a semicircle law that you would just naturally get.
Okay?
It's a very good point.
And so how complicated it is to write this black curve analytically? Or you have it already numerically?
Well, I was gonna include that in my talk, but I think I'm already out of time.
You have so. 2 minutes.
Okay, so the way you do it is this. Every one of them, so let's take translational invariant case, right? That means the local terms are all equal, random but equal. Right? Result will not change if you take it unequal. Right? So you have random interactions. Let's take it to the translational invariant. So every one of the summons has one large identity tensor with two terms. So the eigenvalues of one of those little h's is easy to obtain because they're small. Right? So basically, you have those eigenvalues with the degeneracy of d to the n minus l. Right? So same eigenvalues just blow up in every one of the summons. So every one of the summons we understand very well. The problem is when you add them. Right? You don't add trivially, they mix here. So, however, if every one of the summons we understand, we can find this R transform. And that relies on the eigenvectors being da da da. So you find the R transform of 1. In the case where it's translationally invariant, you just scale the R transform with n, multiplied by n, because every one of them add. Right? You have now n summons, right? Every one of them add. So you have an R transform on the full chain, in which case you start undoing your steps. You go back, you find the Cauchy transform, then you'll have. You're familiar with free probability, I take it, right? Okay. So then from there, you'll get the Cauchy transform, from which if you want to get the distribution, you have a branch cut. And then you take it from the positive reals. And there is a theorem, Clemens-Sopolz, I cannot pronounce it, you use to get the distribution, to get the inverse
distribution.
Okay. Yes.
So you're saying you, for the purpose of the calculation, you pretend that they are free?
Yes.
Okay.
And can you prove that in some asymptotics? Or?
Can
one prove it in some asymptotics if they're free?
They're not free.
No, they're not.
They look like
they're not.
But
right?
Asymptotic doesn't.
Asymptotically, they can go to infinity.
Okay, so that was.
What do you mean by it?
So I don't know. Is there an asymptotic in which?
That's a good question. There are two ways of doing asymptotics. One is you keep n fixed, you take d to infinity, number of sites. Number of sites fixed.
Wait, n was the number of sites?
N is the number of sites, d is the dimensionality of the site.
Right. So which one you fix?
So there are two ways of doing that asymptotically. Mm-hmm. Take n to be 2. if d to infinity, you have a Marchenko Pastorov. So it's asymptotic to free. And it wouldn't be surprising if you had, you know, finite number of summons, you took d into infinity, you would have something that's asymptotic to free. However, if you take d to be finite, say 5, 4, you take n to infinity, it probably is not asymptotic.
You have localization.
So it depends how you take the asymptotic.
But these are the regimes that you can identify in which both go to infinity and you are asymptotically free.
So there is a result actually by Aram and Hastings, and the person who's also in here. Where they talk about this, and they'll show you that when d goes to infinity, they give you the minimum, maximum, and minimum value.
I'm asking something else. You take dnn to infinity, it should be the case. You take dnn to infinity, it should be the case that when d goes faster than n in some way.
So there is it. So imagine that d is much smaller than n.
Yes.
So then what you have is what is called random band matrix. So this the width is d and the length is n.
Okay, very good.
And then it depends what is the ratio of d to n.
Right.
So if d is small, so the conjecture is that d is smaller than square root of n, then I have localization. And if d is greater than square root of n, then it should be.
Do you get free independence then? That is my question.
Yes. So there are partial results. So I think.
Let's let us talk rather. I'll be interested. So let me just show you two other plots. Okay, 5 local. Now 6 local I included not because I'm insane, but because it's sanity check. 6 local means you have one random matrix on the whole chain. Right? You know, interacting the whole thing is just doesn't seem very something rational. But it's a check that the theory is matching numerics like it should.
But this black curve is analytical. It has such a kicks, or it's an optical illusion.
It's analytical. It's continuous.
Yes.
Trust me. Let me just conclude with a few remarks, because I've been told that the alarm clock is alarming. So we can describe the whole spectrum of these generic quantum many-body Hamiltonians. Our results are universal, of course, because you input the distribution of the values of the local interaction, and there comes a curve out. So the results in that respect are universal. And you know, quantum mechanics is an eigenvalue problem, right? So if you have eigenvalues, it's a very good start for many things, right? You can hope for finding eigenvectors and so on and so forth. And lastly, I guess I just want to also say that I definitely am a fair believer that the interface among quantum information, random matrices, and free probability is very exciting and promises to do many wonderful things in the future. Lastly, thank you for your presence and attention. It's just that if there are not any urgent questions, we end here for today. Okay, so let's thank Ramis again. Thank you.